from our universe, and everything which does not suit us is eventually out of our universe, so the universe now fits the data. So, in short, for inflation, in favor of inflation, I think we can summarize it very easily by saying inflation solves all the cosmological, all the known, more or less. It actually does that using only general relativity plus a couple of scalar fields. All this is discussed in a semi-classical way. So, in other words, this is plainly understood physics, GR, and field theory, and even actually classical field theory. It can be, although that's not that obvious, but it can be implemented in high energy theories, and to some people that actually means it can be implemented in string theory, and therefore it can make sense. That's a very strong statement that I will not share, in fact. Also, inflation as a regular physical theory should makes falsifiable prediction, and as any physical theory that is reasonable, not only does it make falsifiable predictions, but this falsifiable prediction turns out to be consistent with all the known observations. And moreover, as I said, it's also possible to do some kind of brain inflation and therefore to implement that in string theory, so it really seems to be perfectly reasonable. And therefore,
I'm just curious, you listed variogenesis as a problem, and we should solve by first.
No. I cited all the problems of the standard model without inflation, and yes, of course, it should not have appeared on the same footing as the other ones. Sorry for that. Yes, it's been a mix between what I said. Yes, of course, biogenesis is not solved by inflation, not that I know of.
You can add extra fields.
Oh, yeah, you can work it out.
Yeah.
But it's not in the standard paradigm.
Yeah, that's right.
It's one of the falsifiable predictions it makes.
Okay, well, assuming, for instance, lower inflation, you'd expect a scaling bound spectrum of perturbation. You put perturbation initially in a vacuum, and you have a well-defined vacuum state to evolve this, and you end up with a scaling bound spectrum of perturbation. Some people will say it's not missing, it's not exactly a prediction. I think it's sort of is a prediction anyway. It's kind of a generic prediction that works. And it also predicts Gaussian fluctuations, which is also observed.
So falsifiable in the sense that if it starts scaling during inflation, you bring down.
Yeah. Sorry. So therefore, you may ask, why would I bother about?
Well, it could have been, just to say on that point, it could have been carbon strings, and there would have been only 150 feet, and it would have been ruled out.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, but the problem is that we have the data now, so we know.
Well, no, but I mean, but you're pushing it.
Yeah, inflation. Now, yes, true. Now, although a bit of cosmic string, a piece of cosmic string is not completely excluded either.
Oh, no, I
there's another way to rule it out is by measuring the ratio of the gravitational wave perturbations to
the scalar, the tensor to scalar ratio is also a prediction. But for the time that being, it's just a prediction, it's not been observed yet. Maybe. If we're lucky and if the simplest possible model of inflation turns out to be correct, then we may observe it, it will be at the limit of observance in Planck, hopefully. So in any case, I'm going to be bothered about alternative models and anything which is not inflation to try and find something else. So why should I bother? Well, the first thing, as I said, you can implement inflation in a string framework, but then if you take string theory at face value, it also has many other possibilities. And in fact, implementing inflation in string theory, even though it's possible, it's definitely not the only possibility. So there are many other models. Actually, the first model in string cosmology was the Prebig-Bong model, but there are many brain models, string gas cosmology, lots of different theories, different implementation in string theory that are possible and that are presumably worth investigating. Whether you believe or not in string theory. Well, of course, in inflation is discussed scales that are almost proposed that the quantum gravity scale, quantum gravity, quantum cosmology, this also must be taken into account. But that's not here that I'm going to discuss this quantum gravity idea. Then everyone says that inflation solves all the problem. Does it really? It's not absolutely obvious. For instance, in inflation, you always end up with a singularity. I mean, you begin with a singularity anyway. You still have an initial condition problem. Homogeneity is actually alleviated, but it's not completely solved, so to speak. So it still is, there still is a room for some discussion. Now, in most of the alternatives, you find a bounce, which is why I'm going to discuss this, either in the string frame or in the Einstein frame, but eventually you end up with a bounce. And these bounds are pretty nice because they provide a challenger. And because even though I've been looking for an alternative model for something which would not be inflation, you can also turn it around and say, well, if I have at least a challenger, then I can compare two theories. And when I will decide at the end, it will reinforce one of them or roll it out. But even for inflation, it is good to have challenger. Okay, now inflation also has its own caveats. The first one, the very first problem that inflation has to face is the origin of a scalar field. Inflation is always implemented by means of a scalar field. And I can remind you that we have never observed a fundamental scalar field in nature. So basing all cosmology on something which actually has never been observed is kind of...
This scalar field doesn't need to be fundamental, is that so?
No, it doesn't need to be fundamental either. But if it's composite, I don't know if it is very... I mean, I know there are models which use composite fields, composite like Fermi and bifermi to form a condensate and to have inflation going on. But as far as I can tell, they're not the best... they're not working that well. So it's... but, okay, that still is a problem. At least, maybe seen as a problem. Another point which is really simple is the problem of the transplanking. I mean, if you take any types, any lengths, even the actual size of the Hubble radius now, and propagate it backwards in time, you will always end up at a time where this scale is smaller than the Planck lengths. And in fact, that's the problem because very often what you do is you put initial condition precisely at this scale, precisely at this instant of time, where the Planck and where the Planck effect, the Planck gravity effect, should be taken into account most definitely. Okay, then, as I said, the singularity hierarchy is also another problem. Like you always have in your theory, you will always have with a parameter which has to be less than 10 to the minus 12, more or less. This is related to the observation that the fluctuation in the CMB are of the order of 10 to the minus 6. So this is this may not be as a problem, seen as a problem, but it's a very small number, not pleasant. Finally, there have been kinds of discussion on the validity of GR at this stage when it's using GR plus a scalar field, where the typical energy of inflation is 10 to the minus 3 of the Planck mass. That will be something like, it's not clear that using classical GR at this stage is efficient. Of course, it's arguable in both ways, so I just wanted to list the caveat. Now, as I said, the alternative is essentially taking into account a bounce, and the history of bouncing cosmology is pretty old, in fact. It's not at all a recent idea. In fact, it's much older than inflation, since the first paper I think ever written on this topic was, the actual scientific paper, not philosophical ones, but I mean, would be that of Tolman in 1931, followed in 1933 by Lemaître. And then, okay, there have been quite a lot of work, but the general idea is a little bit, in the face of it, it looks a little bit like inflation, in fact, is the following. You assume that at some stage you create one universe, somehow. Nowadays we use the word of quantum creation. In these days, of course, they would not be using these kind of words, but anyway, so you have a very small universe that goes up and down, I mean, that expands, contracts again, and this one contains a certain amount of entropy. Then at some stage, you make a bounce. You don't know exactly how you make the bounce. I mean, in the 30s, of course, it was absolutely impossible to make a bounce, so it was just assumed that somehow a bounce will occur. And then once you've bounced, then you have the second periodic expansion, which contains more entropy than the first one. That's just pure thermodynamical consideration that is telling you that the entropy is supposed to increase with time. So the second universe is actually having more entropy, and then you go on and on and on, and you see that the envelope should eventually look like an exponential, which is back to inflation again. But so that's the general idea. That doesn't work. In fact, you have loads of black hole formations and things at the time of the bounce itself. But still, that was the main idea. Now, more recently, there have been many, many other models. I will just quote very rapidly the Predic-Blanc and the ecperiodic scenario. Just couldn't not mention it here. And then, more recently, there have been many, many other models which involve the bounds, like modified gravity, quantum cosmology, of course, that's at bounds, and others.
So I'm just curious why you say it doesn't work. We don't know exactly what happens in the bounds.
No. This category of model, just eventually, or they will give you the same thing as inflation, since the envelope here would be an exponential, or it will tell.
But that's an envelope over many cycles.
The idea was that, in fact, if I remember properly, that's Penrose's argument was saying that you will create far too many black holes in this category of models.
Well, I think Roger was that. I mean, that near the end of one cycle, there might be a lot of black holes. There'd be a large degree of inhomogeneity.
Yeah.
And the question is whether in the course of the bounce. Well, yes. I don't know if it doesn't mean you would not bounce, but in the question, if you do bounce, is there some mechanism for homogenizing the space-time again so that you come out of the bounce with spatially homogeneous?
Yeah, that's the problem for saying.
You don't know the mechanism.
No, but exactly, these models don't have a mechanism for bouncing anyway.
Well, then it's...
So...
but I mean, if it were to be implemented, then the mechanism could...
Well, I don't know. If you arrive in a contracting phase with already many, many black holes and a very highly inhomogeneous state, then you might preferentially go to like a BKL instability or these kind of things rather than to a regular bounce. But this is all very model dependent. And actually, and this is something I will discuss. Most of the bounce models are very model dependent. Any statement, it's very difficult to find a generic statement on a bounce. And this is, I think, the reason why there are so many different models, because people are desperate about finding generic solutions and generic properties of bounce, and they don't find them. I think I will try and explain why it's not possible and what it is we get instead. Okay, so the idea is extremely simple. I'm not going to enter that. The idea is that the curvature, when you go backwards in time, the curvature just increases, and you want to regularize that with thanks to quantum gravity effect in much the same way as you regularize the black body radiation by quantum effect as well. And since you've regularized, you end up with... instead of having a divergent curvature, you regularize it, and therefore it reaches a maximum. And what does it do after that? It has to decrease again. So this is the typical pre-Big-Bang vision of the model. And this is in the string frame. Then if you go, as I said, in the Einstein frame, that translates into a bounce. So, and I think this is again quite a.
Is that the scale factor?
That. Is the scale factor, yeah, absolutely. So in fact, this will be super inflation and a bounce in the Einstein frame. So this is a typical scenario that doesn't work. Another way of implementing, sorry, when I say it doesn't work, I mean it doesn't produce a scale invariant spectrum of perturbation, so you cannot really compare it with observation. I'm not saying it doesn't work on a theoretical at a theoretical level. Now, another scenario which is more involved is to assume a purely five-dimensional model. In this case, that's an Ojala-Witten representation of M theory, where you adjust two brands living in the five-dimensional space, two four-dimensional brands, and you express the overall theory. You freeze essentially all the degrees of freedom, and you end up with a very simple action, which is five-dimensional gravity plus the scalar field in a specific potential. This scalar field being nothing but the distance between the brand. And then again, you can integrate again the fifth dimension out and end up with a four-dimensional theory, this time with four-dimensional Einstein gravity plus a scalar field in a weird potential. And that's what you have. The potential is an exponential potential. That's even better because if you have an exponential potential, then, in fact, you can calculate absolutely everything.
When you say string theory, what did you quotation marks? This is an effective thing.
Absolutely. This is an effective string.
It doesn't do full blatted string theory.
No.
Because we don't know how to do that.
Oh, no, not only don't we know how to do that, but I think in this category of model, I was interested in bounces to begin with, because my feeling is that one of the most important problems in primordial cosmology is the singularity problem. And in this category of model, in fact, you have a singularity still. So it is argued that you have a phase of slow contraction followed by a singularity here, which is pretty mild, being a Milne singularity. So it is claimed that you can calculate what happens through this singularity. It is, as far as I can say, it is not an obvious result. And then you bounce off, and you have the regular expansion. So this is in this category of scenario, which is completely different. In fact, it's essentially five-dimensional. It's not clear what is happening, and you're having a singularity. In fact, my understanding of it is that you need to have a singularity here to have to reproduce a scale invariant spectrum of perturbation. But you need to have a regular bounce. In fact, if you want to have regularized tension gravity waves, so it's. There is some kind of discrepancy there, but I don't want to enter into the details of this category of model because it's changing very often, and I'm not quite sure what is the current state of affair. So let me move to first. Let me apologize for this slide because I actually made this slide when I just discovered how it was possible to include moving things and food, movies, and things, and therefore. It may give you a headache. I'm sorry about that. Okay, so the first problem is of course singularity. Which I'm sorry, I really have to. I should have changed it, but okay. at least it will help you keep you awake. Okay, so the singularity problem is of course not a problem if I consider a regular bounce. Where everything is, there is never a singularity, and I modified it later. Then the horizon problem. The horizon problem, as I remind you, the horizon is not a local quantity, it's a global quantity. There is very often a confusion between horizon and Hubble. My guess is that it's because it begins with the same letter H. But in any case, the horizon problem is being an integral over all the history of the universe. It's kind of easy if you have a big universe at all times. If you have an universe which is defined at all times, meaning initial times going to minus infinity, it is easy to have this quantity diverging, and therefore you don't have any horizon because anything can, at some stage, be in causal contact with anything else. So that's this. These problems are solved very rapidly. The flatness problem, yeah?
Doesn't that depend on whether or not bounces really thermalize? What if bounce puts you out of thermal equilibrium, which seems to be conceivable?
Yes. Yes, for the last part of what I said, yes, it is true that you need to thermalize if you want to solve this horizon problem. Although there is, at least it's true that you don't have a horizon. That's but then the thermal horizon, absolutely, which is what we observe, and could be not there. Yes, absolutely. Okay. So you need to ensure that, indeed. Yeah, but the horizon itself, at least it's alleviated because now you need to have just the dynamical mechanism, thanks to which you can have thermal contact with everything, whereas in standard cosmology already the horizon anyway is very small. So it's not even a question of thermalizing or whatever. It's the horizon being very small. You won't have causal contact anyway. So the flatness problem is in fact quite simple. Usually when you write it down when you want to justify inflation, you say that the ratio of the density to the flat density, which is this omega, which must be one for the flat universe, then the time variation is given by this relation, which is the acceleration and the rate of expansion. And then what you say is that if you want this to be negative, then of course A double dot, assuming you have an expansion, A double dot must be positive, and therefore you need to have a phase of accelerated expansion. And now, of course, the same argument can be reversed by just changing both of the sign, and then you have a period of decelerated contraction, and this period of decelerated contraction must be obviously followed by a bounce if we want to observe that in a currently expanding phase. So this is a very simple hand-waving argument. Of course, this is just to give you an idea to how we can solve these problems. It's not the actual solution, but in practice, that's how it works. So homogeneity problem is solved now, I think, I don't know if it is that nice, but it works in a completely different way. And now, remember, you want to have a contraction, so you start up with a large universe. You start with a large and flat universe, which has, I mean, almost flat, sufficiently flat, because of this, assume that it has contracted sufficiently long time. Then it is large, and then you assume that low energy, low density implies low curvature. It's not obvious. And take into account diffusion of particles between one another. And then for a given length scale, lambda, you can compare this length scale with the radius, with the Hubble radius here, and then you can calculate the dissipation time relative to the Hubble time, and you find out that for any wavelength, any possible wavelength, it is always possible to find a situation where this dissipation time is much, much smaller than the typical Hubble time. And in fact, the situation is essentially similar to in a room when you open the door, and if you neglect gravity, which is, even though gravity is not negligible on Earth, it is at the level of particles, at the dissipation level. So you will end up with having essentially uniform and homogeneous box at the end. So this is essentially telling you that all these things means that we assume that sound waves do not condense, they do not collapse. And therefore, you end up with a state which is well homogeneous, and that out of which you can define a vacuum state. Now, the perturbations, and the perturbations are the problem, and I'm going to precisely discuss on these ones. And other problems such as dark matter, dark energy, biogenesis, all these problems are not addressed, neither in inflation nor here. Yes?
May I just ask a question about homogenization? The diffusion smooths out the inhomogeneities of the future. Now, why does that not work if you go back in time towards the singularity in a regular universe? Because there were theorems back in the 80s that said that you couldn't do that using viscosity and diffusion in a regular cosmological model.
Yeah. In a regular cosmological model, now, let me remember what it was. I think you're not in this situation, so that you are, the rate of expansion is, I don't remember the argument. I think the rate of expansion was not sufficiently small that you could actually neglect it in front of diffusion. And whereas here, I'm not saying that it works, but I'm saying it's a possibility that you can imagine, you know, the expansion, the universe as we know it, whereas the phase of contraction, we sort of can say, you know, essentially anything we want because we don't have any real access to it. So we can assume that the dissipation, you know, we cannot have a theorem on what happens in dissipation in the contracting phase, because we don't know what's the contracting phase, what it is dominated by or anything. So we can assume that the Hubble time is indeed negligible, is indeed very long with respect to any dissipation we can have.
Okay.
And I don't think these theorems you mentioned, I don't think they would apply in this situation. Or, phrase it differently, I think I can imagine a model in which they would not apply. And that's simply that.
Does this not make the peculiar velocities very small, but it still doesn't eliminate the homogeneity? In fact, we have gravitational pumping.
I'm not sure I understood you.
Well, so I'm understanding what specifically is dissipating in this case, because with expansion, your peculiar velocity is becoming normal.
Yeah.
But you still have a formation of.
Oh, right. But no. But in this case, we start with a very low density. So if the density is very low, even relatively large inhomogeneities will not collapse because the density is sufficiently low to begin with. So it's a mix between a theory of initial conditions and typically like a Vell kind of initial condition. And so we assume something on the Vell tensor as well. And the dynamics of the dissipation. So it's a mix between these two things. So indeed, we don't have a collapse, but it's because we ensured it to begin with. I'm trying to show that it may be possible to have this category of model working, but I'm not claiming that we do have a model that works. I'm just claiming that it is possible. And, or more precisely, that it's not been ruled out yet. Now, the crucial point, of course, is the perturbation. The perturbation, we know that we have in a contracting phase, essentially, and I think essentially all the models agree on that, we start off with a contracting phase which is ruled by Einstein general relativity plus fluid, scalar field, anything, just name it. But at the end, we know exactly what we're doing here. So we have two modes of contraction during the contraction, two modes of perturbation, a growing mode and a decaying mode. Now, of course, and we find in the literature many, many arguments saying, okay, I obtain these modes, and therefore I compare that with observation. I completely disagree with the idea, because what you want to do is to compare with observation here. Observation is made in the expanding phase, not during the contracting phase. So as long as you don't know what happened through the bounds, you don't know nothing. And this is, again, why I don't like when you have a singularity in the middle, because I think you could essentially do anything you want. So in any case, there are a couple of possibilities, but you have either the theory remains, becomes non-linear at the bounds, in which case you can hardly say anything, because you would have to redo all the calculation, and essentially all your initial condition that made put in a contracting phase will be wiped out by the non-linear terms, or the theory remains linear, which is why let's hope that it works. If it remains linear, then of course the growing mode and the decaying mode in the expanding phase must be linearly related with the same mode in the contracting phase. And therefore there is a given transfer matrix, and then since this is a transfer matrix, it can be anything except that it is linear. And if it is anything, it can also depend on scale. And there was this argument saying that it cannot depend on scale. It's an argument which is not often written, but it's said explicitly very often. That goes very simply as follows. It's telling you it's a causality argument, in quote, saying that the duration of the bounds being very small, it cannot affect very long wavelengths. This argument is for causality reason. This argument would make sense. In fact, it doesn't make sense. If you consider, say, a closed universe, it is a three-sphere, all the modes are excitation over this three-sphere. All the modes are, of course, smaller, even the largest possible and conceivable mode as, of course, smaller than the actual size of the sphere. When it bounces, the sphere itself stops and bounces. Therefore, the zero mode, which is the sphere, is affected by the mode, by the bounce. And therefore, I don't see any reason why any mode which is actually smaller than that would not be affected, whatever the duration of the bounce. So I think this argument is just not valid. And indeed, it is not. So let me just, I'm afraid I'm going very slowly, but okay, I will first to illustrate a particular bounce. So even though I said we have problems with scalar field and things like that, I myself began by putting a scalar field, and indeed the very simplest model you can think of that does a bounce is simple 4D. I will always consider four-dimensional theories from now on. 4D GR plus a scalar field in a potential, and if I want to have a bounce, you see the Friedman equation is that one, and it has the spatial curvature here. If I want a bounce, I want H to go to zero, and clearly for H going to zero, if either the density must go to zero, but in which case you will have another problem, which is the density, or the spatial curvature is positive. Positive spatial curvature is the only way to essentially break or violate what would be null energy condition in this case. So if I have a positive spatial curvature and a specific shape of the potential must have a maximum because of the field at its maximum would generate the bounce. Here is a typical trajectory three typical trajectories in a phase space or with time. You see, that's the Hubble rate. It starts essentially constant and negative, so it's a contracting de Sitter phase that reaches an expanding de Sitter phase right after the bounce. Here is the scale factor. And in phase space, it goes like you start at one of the minimum of the potential, starts oscillating, and as much as you oscillate, since you are contracting, the contraction acts like an anti-friction, and therefore the more you contract, the more you oscillate until some stage where you actually reach the maximum, which is there, and then you will start collapsing, you will start expanding and going down in the potential. And so the field is actually slowly rolling in the potential then. So you have an expansion, an inflation phase here, in fact. Now, the difference, of course, in this category of model is that you're not obliged to have 60E fold, because the 60E fold is there to solve the problem, which, as I argue, can be solved in a different manner. So you will have a de Sitter phase, but it's not necessarily an inflation phase.
So, you still need it with all the flatness, I guess, because you have a large curvature at the airport.
Actually, you have a large curvature at the bounce itself.
Yeah.
What happens is that, in fact, the curvature, the omega minus 1, or omega goes to 1, say, omega goes very strongly to 1 all along before the bounce. And then it diverges, it gets out of 1 for a very short period of time, and then goes back. It's kind of symmetric. You can manage to have a symmetric bounce. So if you've had a very long period of time during which omega was going to 1, then at the bounce itself it will have a weird behavior, but then immediately afterwards it will get back to its original value. So it does. So the idea is to say, well, let's assume the phase of contraction lasted much longer than the current phase of expansion. And then you solve it.
If you solve this problem with a perfect fluid, you have rho and p.
Yeah.
You can show that you only get a bounce in double bounce positive.
Yeah.
If you have a negative pressure, you have to violate one of the engine conditions.
Absolutely. You have to violate the...
You write an engine momentum tensor for the minimally coupled theory, scalar theory. You can identify p and q, and you will find that p has to be negative.
Yeah. In fact, we did that some years ago, and we did it exactly with that, with a perfect fluid, and we investigated under which condition we could have a bounce, and concluded that in this category of model, it was not possible to have a bounce, because not only do you violate the null energy condition, but this, of course, violating the null energy condition is quite bad to begin with, but it would not be a sufficient reason to rule the model out. Now, the problem is that if you do that, and you calculate the perturbation, of course, all the perturbations explode at the time, precisely at the moment where you violate the null energy condition. And therefore, these models are unstable.
Yeah, so in a sense, a bounce is an instability.
Hmm?
A bounce is a kind of instability.
Oh, yes. Very often you can do the bounce with, with negative energy scalar field, with, well, you know, the bounce in GR is violating the null energy condition. So one way or another, you will end up with some singularity, with some instability somewhere.
So if you have a modified gravity theory, you have extra degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
Then you may not violate the null.
Absolutely. In your category of theories, you will have a, you will have a bounce that will be produced by the instability, sort of. Yes?
I'm just trying to make sure I understand correctly. Only the thing driven to one as you approach the bounces. And then omega is driven away from one. What is causing omega to go away from one during this period? What's driving that?
The fact that the curvature is dominant. The curvature is really what dominates at the bounce.
What's causing the curvature?
Oh, because the that's
not possible.
Well, because h goes to zero. Therefore, the term, you see, you can manage to do everything in such a way that k is this term would be negligible all along. But at the bounce itself, it cannot be made negligible. Actually, this is the term thanks to which you can, I mean, this, which annihilate this one. So it, these two terms must be exactly equal at the bounce by definition.
H dot is zero.
And a dot is zero. Yeah, h equals zero. See, that's the problem. Now, in this category of bounces, what we found is that the duration of the bounce in conformal time is limited. And this is extremely important because if because since you have a limited duration in conformal time, the potential for the perturbation depends on the conformal on the second derivative of with respect to conformal time of the scale factor. And it turns out that in these kind of models, this is limited. So you would expect not to see anything in the perturbation. This is why we checked by doing a different kind of theories. Since GR doesn't agree with, doesn't let you have a bounce, we took some other category of model, which are non-singular theories. And we took this with this particular scaling, with this particular invariant, which is this one. It looks pretty much like a Gauss-Bonnet term. Except it's not, of course, otherwise it wouldn't have any effect. And so we put a Lagrange parameter in a potential, and we can work it out. And in this category of model, you don't need spatial curvature. And in fact, so I will not enter the details, but here is a typical, here are typical trajectories which you might end up with. And you see the Hubble scale does the it has the same kind of behavior, slightly weirder there, but it has essentially the same kind of behavior as before. But now you're not limited in terms of the bounce duration. So in fact, the saying that the bounce duration is constrained is completely equivalent with saying that the bounce is a curvature-dominated bounce. Now, if you have any theory which manages to have a bounce with no curvature, then the duration of the bounce is absolutely arbitrary. And since the duration of the bounce is absolutely arbitrary, then the perturbations which you might produce with it are also absolutely arbitrary. I mean, they are not necessarily bounded. So now, precisely, let me move to this perturbation. I will skip that and go to the perturbation themselves. So here is a typical category of models. Where, in fact, what we have, now here are the perturbations, I just wrote them in a specific way, to rewrite them in terms of a Schrödinger kind of equation. And this thing is a potential, and you see that in this category of bounds, and this, I think, exemplifies why it is not possible to have a generic situation in the bounds case, because here is the potential. So close to the bounds, the potential is, in fact, you see, you have two possibilities. Either the potential is large close to the bounds and vanishing afterwards, or it is in this situation, the potential is essentially small and not very much interesting close to the bounds, and then it grows far from the bounds. So that means that, as a matter of fact, in this Schrödinger-like equation, it satisfies the WKB condition inside, that means close to the bounds, but not far from the bounds. So it sounds bizarre because then you cannot, where are you going to put your initial condition? So one possibility would be to put the initial condition at the bounds, say we are, say, in vacuum or whatever at the bounce. I don't like this possibility because I don't know how I could get there. I mean, the bounce is perhaps a peculiar moment of time, but not the moment, not an initial time. It's just a bounce. So I think what you have to do is to put the initial condition far away from the bounce. And you have to assume that, of course, this theory is not complete. This theory is just describing the bounce, and it does not describe what happens beforehand. So what we did, just to check what was going on, is we assume that there is another theory and that this thing which diverges far from the bounds eventually goes down again. It's the symmetric part of the re-eating. Here, if you had an inflation time, this will go up, and then eventually it goes down, and then you have the re-eating. So that will be sort of a re-cooling here. Sorry, I'm plotting here. That's the potential, meaning this quantity, as a function of time during the bounce. So this is this thing, and this one, these are for two different values of the parameters which we have underneath.
And that oscillating one is an oscillating one.
And the oscillation, and the oscillating one, I'm coming to it, is now, since WKB is broken, is dilated, sorry, where I should put my initial condition, as I said, I assume that the potential at some stage eventually decreases, and that here, say, I can put initial conditions in a regular way. I do that, and if I do that, I would expect to have arriving here two modes, again, which would be essentially power loads, presumably. It's just to fix the idea. So I start with a power load here, and then I investigate the value. So this is a mode, one of the modes that arrives with a power load in K, which is therefore a constant in time, and then it oscillates because, which, I mean, that's normal. Here, here we are above the potential. WKB works in here, so you have this oscillation, and then again it goes again there. And this is the quantity, that's the curvature perturbation, the zeta here, the curvature perturbation, which turns out to be not conserved. This is not obvious at all in here, but it's not conserved, in fact. So in any case, what you end up with, you do that for various different modes. This is for one mode. So it starts from here, and it arrives slightly above. And this is for one value of k. And you redo it for all values of k, and you end up with this particular spectrum, which you can actually calculate analytically. This is what it gives you. And this is not a misprint, unfortunately. Or I don't know if it is so unfortunate, but to begin with, I was expecting that it would give a correction, like superimposed oscillation on the spectrum. It is not superimposed oscillation. It is an actual oscillation of the spectrum itself. So indeed, the spectrum really goes to zero. So when I saw that to begin with, the first time I got this result, I said, well, okay, so this category of model is obviously ruled out. Because when you look at the data, well, of course, you're going to see, yes, we see oscillations, but these are, the acoustic oscillations are well controlled. But even there or here, you don't find any oscillations. So since there is no oscillations and we have so large oscillation in our spectrum, it seems that we have a problem. In fact, this would be the case if it were not for, in particular in here, for the window function. Because when you do these measurements, you have a window function. And you have window function, you have binning, you have loads of things. And as a matter of fact, when we put our oscillations, we can compare them with, say, the WMAP data, and this is what we get. Thanks to the window function, everything is smoothed out, and things don't go to zero or whatever. Now, of course, as I gladly acknowledge our discussion from yesterday, because one thing is, if this window function is reduced, which will obviously, well, hopefully it happen in the future, then this oscillation might eventually be possible to see. And I hope it will be the case. I know I'm not alone, but let's see what will happen. So at least, and this particular oscillation, as you see, you can fit it in the WMAP data in a quite simple way. So this is one category of model which has, as a definite prediction for the bounce, the existence of oscillation in the power spectrum. And these oscillations have a definite shape. So this is really falsifiable. I hope it will not be falsified too rapidly, but at least it's falsifiable. So I don't know if I'm right, but I know I'm doing physics. Yeah.
space so far out, but in this modified gravity theory, where you calculate the power spectrum, you get unit oscillations if you don't have dark matter. And I've actually looked at the places of the oscillations, the lowest point. You can identify the voids.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're looking at is the survey of distribution of galaxies. And you see these voids, and these voids correspond to oscillations in the power spectrum.
Oh, good. I haven't checked these. But that's,
So in a sense, we may have already seen it.
Well, I just hope you'll...
I mean, this
it's
is
true.
Speculation. It's worth thinking about.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Can I see the previous slide once more? The one. Okay. So you're saying the potential has a specific k dependence, then I
No. This potential, which is the potential is this one, right?
It doesn't have k dependence.
No, it doesn't depend. That's this at the full curve here. I assume a scale invariant spectrum indeed here initially, and you see this is what I get. This is the scale invariant spectrum I put to begin with.
So what's theta again?
Theta is this function of the background. I'm sorry, this is a little bit confusing, yeah.
So the bounces that you get in that next picture, wiggles in the, next one. Yeah, those little wiggles.
Yep.
They're set by the parameters
yep.
of the potential.
Absolutely.
Right? How finely adjusted do you have to?
Well, this is that was very preliminary. That was just to see that indeed it was possible to adjust the data. I have a student right now who is actually doing that and incorporating this. I have two new parameters, in fact, to see. Where are they? You see, with respect to the normal spectrum, I have two new parameters. Which is this omega and k. It looks like it's only one, but in fact it's actually two, because you have a pivot scale here, and then you have a frequency. And so you are actually having two new parameters, and he's including that in some sort of an extended COM simulation to actually check what are their value.
Where do those parameters come from again, ultimately?
Ultimately, they come from the bounce itself, which is, so they are given by the duration of the bounds. And you see, it comes from the fourth derivative of the scale factor. Because theta here already involved the second derivative of the scale factor. So here there is a second derivative. So that's the fourth order derivative of the scale factor. So you can actually write all these parameters in terms of, make an expansion of the bounds in terms of, say, a Taylor series. Taylor series near the bounds, and you have all the parameters all the way to the fourth order that enters this game. So it also depends on the initial value for the scalar field which you put to begin with, and the initial value if it's velocity, and there are many numbers which you can put in here. The point is not, I think my point right here was not actually to forge a model that would work. As I said, first of all, as I will say in a minute, first of all, you will have to connect this one to a cooling phase or a pre-cooling phase. And this, we don't know yet how to do that. So it's not possible to forge a complete model yet. We have hints that it is possible, but it's not yet done. So I would not be, even though it looks like that's what I'm doing, in fact, I'm not really comparing with the data. Well, first of all, because there are WMAP3 data and not WMAP7, so it's very old data. But still, I would not really compare right now with the data. It is part of a project. My student, Mark Lille, is doing it right now. And maybe sometime he will be able to come over here and explain to you exactly what is the value which has been obtained.
Can I make a couple of points? In the calculations I have, I only have baryons, there's no dark matter. That's when you see the unit oscillations. Put in the window function, smooths them out. But then you have to Fourier transform the two-point correlation function. Because there's a bump, it's called the baryon acoustic oscillation.
Mm-hmm.
A so many megaparsecs. You can see it in the data.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be able to fit that as well. I do. So the two are connected. Anyway, the problem is that if there is no dark matter, then you begin to see the unit oscillations in my model. And as you increase the accuracy of the SDSS data. So you're going to have a degeneracy between your oscillations and mine.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And you have to decide.
But I don't know if your oscillations also have this sort of strong effect as well in the CMD. But if they do, of course, then they might be different. And
I just want to mention, there's another talk starting at 4 o'clock.
Okay, so I'm really... Okay. Let me try then to go very rapidly. So as I was saying, so what we have now, the typical bounds we have, the characteristic bounds, gets this... this figure, like you have a de Sitter contraction, a de Sitter expansion, again, not necessarily of the 60-fold, which is required by inflation. Then you have the bounds in between. There you have the radiation-dominated epoch, so therefore the, you have the preheating here. And then you expect to have something else, which without pre-cooling for some reason, well, just for symmetry reason. And where, in fact, we are working on that currently with Raoul Abramo. I think we should be coming soon, I don't remember, anyway. So, and the idea is to assume the contracting phase and try to figure out how we can transform the particles that are in here and how they can form, for instance, a Bose-Einstein condensate that will give me the scalar field which does the bonds or anything. Anyway, this phase is not done at all, again, as I said. So now I want to, since I have not so much time. I wanted to discuss many other situations, but I will not. I'm sorry. I have to skip these things. Then what we've done, another category of model, which I will try to explain as rapidly as I can, is, in fact, it's kind of almost shocking to see that this model works, because it's the simplest possible model you can think of. This is really just purely gravity, four-dimensional gravity, plus a perfect fluid, and even simpler than that, a perfect fluid which is having a constant equation of state. So this is really, it's very difficult to think of a simpler model. Well, okay, the simpler model would be just vacuum, but okay, this doesn't work. But now, just this kind of perfect fluid, for instance, it will solve the horizon problem provided the equation of state be larger than minus one-third or something like that. So only with this perfect fluid, now just don't look at what follows. Okay, here we go. Only with this perfect fluid, we apply the Willard-De-Witt ADM formalism. We just write this in terms of quantum cosmology, make a couple of canonical transformation, rescaling, change in units or whatever, and we end up with a very simple Hamiltonian, which is this one, which in this framework involves a momentum, a conjugate momentum to one of the fluid potential. It is using a formalism where you have fluid and potentials and a canonical momentum which is appearing in a Hamiltonian linearly, and that actually gives you a time variable in a very natural way. Well, that's kind of normal because I have a perfect fluid which has a time-like vector to begin with, so that does define a time. And when I apply Willard-De-Witt equation, this simply gives me an extremely simple wave function, Schrödinger equation for the wave function, which is this one. Okay, again, in the case, for instance, where I have no curvature and I rescale things, and I have this extremely simple free massless particle equation, Schrödinger equation, which I can solve, of course. Capital T is, well, it's a complicated variable made out of the fluid variables, fluid potential. I don't know if you know of Schultz formalism in the 1970s. Which we applied here to this particular case. We have fluid potential. We make, again, a couple of canonical transformation, and that's where we generate this. I mean, I could show you later, but it's a
velocity potential.
It's sort of a velocity potential, yeah. Okay, so we can solve that. I mean, it's all quite simple by means of Gaussian wave packets or whatever. And we end up with a wave function, which is this one. And now, okay, I definitely won't have time to enter this one, but I may not take question right now for that. But what we did, in order to apply that in cosmology, since cosmology, of course, has no external observer, we need to have an interpretation for quantum mechanics, which will work in quantum cosmology, and there are not so many of them. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, there are only two of them. One is the multi-world interpretation, many-world interpretation, which would not tell me anything, and I think anyway all these interpretations are equivalent. What we used was the Bohm de Broglie interpretation, which works perfectly fine in this case. So we have the phase, and we can write down the trajectory, the Bohmian trajectory, which is just the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian, and we find the solution. And now, since this is a Bohm interpretation, the scale factor is the hidden variable, and so you have a trajectory, even though the scale factor is an operator. Now you have it as a trajectory. So it gives you the trajectory of the scale factor, which is what it is, in particular in the k equals 0 case. So you find that you really have a bounce. And the quantum effects are sort of defined here as the quantum potential. And you see you really have an effect only close to the bounce. Now, why is that very useful? First of all, because you can do this calculation, and you can calculate, say, how. Again, away from the trajectory, you could consider just the scale factor itself as an operator and take its mean value, and you will get exactly this curve. And so you could say, okay, well, I have the mean value, so everything's fine. I'm not so sure it's that fine, because the mean value being non-vanishing doesn't mean that at some stage the scale factor would not have an eigenvalue that would vanish, and I don't exactly know whether it means that I do have a singularity or not. In this case, I know I don't have a singularity. But there is another thing, is that I want to go second order, because I want to calculate the perturbations. And if I calculate the perturbations out of a Bohm interpretation, in fact, I can't. There was some work by Halliwell and Hawking in the 80s that was tremendously complicated, leading to absolutely nowhere, and in fact, it had no conclusion, this work. So in here, it's true. I mean, they have horrendously complicated equations, and at the end, that's it. Because you just can't solve them. It's not possible. You have Mode's equations which are intricated, and there is nothing you can say about them. In this case, well, we can expand the Hamiltonian up to second order in perturbation, and we factorize the wave function in a very simple way. But now, since we've solved the zeroth order wave function and assume a Bohmian interpretation, then A is a function of time. So we can plug this function of time here. So we have the second order wave function, and we write the Hamiltonian at the second order, and I haven't done it here, so it has to be on the next one. Here we go. Again, we do a bunch of canonical transformations, and we end up with this extremely simple equation, which we expand in modes, and when you expand that in Fourier modes, you end up with, again, the very simple semi-classical equation. In fact, it's pretty fun because it means, since this is the equation which is essentially used by everyone doing cosmological perturbation, semi-classical perturbation, in fact, it is a little bit like in the French literature, they are doing Bohm interpretation without knowing it, because this is fully consistent in a Bohm interpretation. I don't know if it is consistent, in fact, to do semi-classical gravity like that. I know that this is consistent. I know that semi-classical may not be. Anyway, you end up with this. And for the typical solution, you can actually plot the potential. And the potential is in the other category. Therefore, this time, the potential here, A double prime over A, is just a bell shape close to the bounds. So WKB is actually valid far from the bounds. So you can start up with vacuum initial condition, which are well-defined. You have a Bunch-Davy state, which is well-defined. You make it evolve in time. So here, this is what you have. So you see that you have the imaginary part and the real part, which are not mixed, and you have, that's the Bunch-Davis mode, and then it evolves, it mixes the component, and you again end up with oscillations. amazingly. So, okay, so you can manage to have it. This is valid both for the scalar and the tensor modes. So we did that. Sorry, I must hurry. So we did it. Okay, so we can define the spectrum. Now that we have all the perturbation well defined, I have the spectrum. We do the same work with gravity wave. Again, the same kind of canonical transformation and everything. So we end up, in fact, again, with the same equation. So we have the same equation. Of course, since we still have this bell shape for the potential, we can have the same initial condition for the vacuum state. So same dynamical equation, same initial condition, clearly I'm going to have the same result. So I end up with the same spectrum, both for the scalar perturbation and the tensor perturbations, which is given by this relation. And now, in principle, I should normalize that and to the CMB spectrum, which I know what it is. And that actually gives me what if, okay, this is not detailed here, but the CMB normalization is telling me that the curvature at the bounds is limited. Well, there is no mystery in all that. Of course, the CMB normalization is always the same number. That's 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. And we know that it is very often proportional to the Newton constant. So essentially, the dimensionless number I'm going to have is always roughly the square root of this 10 to the minus 6, which is exactly what I have here. I found out that the curvature at the bounds, the four-dimensional curvature at the bounds, is of the order of 1,000 Planck lengths, which was to be expected. But this is really fine, because that actually means, my understanding is that this is a regime where the Wheeler-DeWitt equation might make sense, where you don't need still a full quantum theory of gravity, where the Wheeler-DeWitt equation makes sense, and it's fine because that's where we used it. So we're very happy, even though we did it in a mini-superspace, so this is arguable. There are maybe problems in coherence problem, but still. So at the end, of course, there is the constraint for the scalar index that constrains the value of W. So our result in this category of bounds, these are, again, the second category, well, a spectrum which can be slightly blue. Okay, that this is, of course, bad news, because we know the spectrum is, if anything, is slightly red. Well, the error bar is sufficiently large still that we can play around with that, but that's our prediction will, for the time being, be pretty bad. And we can, related to what you were saying, we can estimate the ratio of the scalar to tensor mode, which is done in the usual way, especially since it is quite simple, since both spectrum are equal. And we estimate that in inflation, normally, this ratio T over S goes like the scalar index itself, whereas here we have this ratio which goes like the square root of the scalar index. I don't know whether this is observable or not, but I know that if it is observable, it is a definite conclusion. And I think that's it. I thank you for your attention.
Yeah, so there's, if you said this, I missed it, but we observe ourselves to be in a universe that's accelerating. So if we had a bounce, I mean, in these models, is this acceleration going to stop and recontract us again, or is it just one bounce for all time, or what?
Now,
what are you going to do about an accelerating universe?
You're asking me to make a complete model of everything. Yeah, sure. I mean, I would like to do it. I don't know. I think I can. Well, of course, I could come out with a weird model that does that's what you want. What we are considering is really the bounce itself, the phase of the bounce itself, and we are working on what precedes it. Now, what happens after that may be related, may not be. Doing a cyclic scenario is appealing, but I don't know if it is. I don't know if it is the truth. So, it's true that what I like in a cyclic kind of scenario is that, in fact, you don't have to put the initial condition nowhere, because everywhere it eventually repeats itself. In this category of scenario, you start up with a large, big, essentially infinite universe, and you know there was this instability in the, I think it was in the 80s, by there was a paper by Salam and Hans Bardemy. And in the 80s, they showed that if you have a scalar field or something like that, then you might initiate an instability in a Minkowski space. So in fact, our idea was to take a Minkowski space to begin, so which is completely with nothing in it. And this initial instability that would initiate the contraction and then end up with to a bond and all that. So the original idea was not to have to have a cyclic extension. Now, it is possible, but well, right now, for the time being, the first thing would be to reproduce first the current acceleration. It was one of our aim with the modified gravity things to show that we can have a bounce and a period of accelerated expansion afterwards, but it doesn't work, unfortunately.
So at this point in time, you have not reproduced the observed acceleration of the universe. That's correct. At this point in time, you have not.
Yes and no. Well, first of all, I could add a lambda, but then I could do what we discussed yesterday, meaning since I have in the power spectrum, I have these oscillations in the power spectrum. That means I must have some voids somewhere. And maybe then I can put myself in one of these voids and then reproduce an effective acceleration. And this void would be predicted by my perturbations. I don't know if this is really worth it, but I mean it's a possible
answer. Conceptually, in bounce models, if you've got an acceleration in one phase, then something's got to turn it off and get it to contract eventually. At this point in time, to my knowledge, there's no positive evidence.
No.
Is that claiming it repeats?
Pardon?
Is that claiming that it repeats?
Well, that's what I'm trying to ask. Is this a one bounce for all time, or is this an accordion, or what is it?
You can have a bounce, one bounce. It's
resolving just one bounce, but I mean, what happens to the rest of the age of the universe? That's still up for grabs.
Well, the universe was an infinite amount of time backwards. It was an infinite and vacuum state, Minkowski state. That's our initial condition, and we've been waiting an infinite amount of time before anything really happens, which is now. Well. You may like or dislike it.
So we're highly dilute in the past. We decelerate down to this bounce. We accelerate, and now we're enjoying ourselves till we dissipate, and that's all the life.
Absolutely.
That's all you get.
Rather discouraging.
You may dislike it. I mean, it's but this scenario seems to be compatible with the data.
But in your model, that's what it would be.
Yeah. Once. Absolutely. Once. Absolutely.
I want to ask about the second law of thermodynamics. If S is the entropy, then dH to T is supposed to be positive.
Yeah.
Before the bounce and after the bounce. So my suggestion in my model is that T goes to minus T, and then you preserve the second law of thermodynamics. Tolman had a problem with this.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The oscillating model in 1931. Because the entropy keeps increasing.
That's good. This model. That's so fun to this model.
Now, yeah.
What? So before we go off on that direction, is there any other question?
So in this model, we were trying to constrain the value of the curvature at the bounds through CMB normalization.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have imagined a very nice scenario in which I just put in the potential, I have the curvature, and just from the parameters of the potential, I should be able to predict. This is my energy density at which the bounce is going to occur.
As a matter of fact, I don't think so, because the bounce is going to occur as soon as you have the wave function, then you know what is the energy density at the bounce. What the energy density at the bounce and the curvature and everything is in fact a number like an initial condition. Sorry, a boundary condition for the wave function. I contract to an energy density which is of the order of, like you see the typical scale is 10 to the 3 Planck scale, Planck length.
But I thought that you were able to write down that operator for the scale factor.
Yeah.
So I can also write down, if I have a potential, I can write down the operator for the momentum of the scalar field.
Absolutely.
And I can.
Well, I don't know. In this case, I don't have a scalar field, right? Yeah. This is a perfect fluid.
Okay.
But I can construct an operator for the energy density. Yes.
Formalism. One can also write down the energy density for the perfect fluid.
Yeah.
And why one can't raise it to an operator in the Hilbert space?
Well, I could do that. Yeah, sure. It's just I haven't done. It's but it's but I guess the typical energy I will end up with, it's well, it's the scale. It's the curvature scale. I have nothing but the curvature scale. So and with an equivalent of the Friedman equation, I would have a relationship between them.
Okay. So we have to end now. But Patrick will be here on Thursday.
Yeah.
We're gonna take him out to dinner tonight around 6:30, and everybody's welcome to join. Let's thank Patrick.
Thank you.